Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
Good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing good. We have our 10-year anniversary coming up, and we're doing a huge event. And if you haven't bought tickets for it, you're going to be missing out. What are the details on that, Aaron?
Well, the 10-year celebration, wow, I know it's weird. We're doing it months after our actual anniversary, or podversary, as some are calling it. But it's going to be pretty fun because we have some longtime friends joining us, like Charlie from Crime Lines. We have the True Crime Garage guys, Nick and the Captain, Bob Ruff, Josh Hallmark, and we also have Esther from Once Upon a Crime. So quite the crew coming. And we're going to have a mix of things we're doing. We're going to have some retrospectives. We're going to do some trivia, which should be fun, and some fun surprises.
September 8th, 7 p.m., go out to genypod.com to get your tickets. And if you can't be there in person, we have live stream tickets that you can purchase and watch at your leisure or watch live as it's happening. Either way, go out to genypod.com, buy a ticket. And we're trying to make it worth everyone's time with all the guests, super cool personalities we're going to have there. It's like when you get married, it's not really for you, it's for all the people that are attending. And that's what we're trying to do for our listeners.
Also, there's a short update I wanted to give. Anyone that remembers, we covered the Syed sisters, about the two young sisters who were murdered in a taxi cab. Well, their father has now been found guilty and will spend his life in prison for murdering his daughters.
Seems like it took a while, because we covered that a while back and it wasn't a recent case. So it's
nice to see an end here to the case, because this is the kind of case that it really gets under my skin. You need to be betrayed by your own family like that in such a terrible way. And it's since happened, since this trial and everything, it's really come out just how much his wife was under his power. And she let him know that in court, that he was not in control of her. And so that was very nice to see, because you always wonder, like, where was the mom? Well, she eventually did try to get her daughters out of there. That's part of why this went down the way it did. That's because they didn't want to live under his rules anymore. And he became enraged because his wife and his kids were gone.
So, Aaron, tonight's case is, there's a terrible, heinous murder. We have somebody who's convicted of this murder. We have evidence that was enough to overturn his case, but technicalities in the system land this man back on death row. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the August 1984 murder of Mary Ann Flynn in Cleveland, Ohio.
Now, Mary Ann Flynn was 33 years old at the time. She was a midwife and worked at the Cleveland Metropolitan General Hospital. She owned a house on Archwood Drive.
Mary Ann Flynn, she lived in a number of places. You know, she skied in the Alps. She lived in Scotland for a while. She had been in Germany for a while. She was in Michigan at one point. But it was in Cleveland where she really got her roots set down because she wanted to be a midwife. There's a really great article about her that's in the Cleveland Scene. They said she ran a virtual one-woman social service organization out of her home. So she took care of unwed mothers, and she prepared meals for the poor.
That's a lot. That's a lot for one person, and what a wonderful addition to this planet that she was.
Now, the reason we're talking about the Mary Ann Flynn and about a man by the name of Anthony Apanovich is because something happened, something terrible. Let's talk about who Anthony Apanovich was. He was a painter by trade. And he was doing work on that street when Mary Ann hired him to work at her house.
She needed some work. And, you know, and that's kind of how you hire people, you know, whether you're getting a new roof or something painted, you see somebody down the street, you go get their card and you make it happen. But it's August 23rd, 1984. Mary Ann visits her brother at his home. She had left at around 9:30 p.m., and at approximately 10 p.m. that night, a neighbor heard Mary Ann get home, get out of her car, walk to the back door of her duplex, and other neighbors heard her front door close. At around midnight, some neighbors heard a loud bang or thud from inside the house.
Yeah, in fact, one of the neighbors thought, I better go up and check on my kids. And once she realized her kids were fine, she went back downstairs because, well, it wasn't her kids making that sound. You know, I think it might be one of those things where when you have kids, you worry about them falling out of bed or banging their head on a headboard.
So the next day, August 24th, Mary Ann doesn't show up for work. She doesn't contact anybody. And one of her coworkers becomes very worried and tries to contact her, and Mary Ann's not responding, not answering her phone, so she calls Mary Ann's brother, and they're going to try to gain access to Mary Ann's house, right?
Right, and Mary Ann had a duplex, but she rented out one side. What they would do is they go through the tenant side, and if you go into the basement of the tenant side, you can go through the basement, and then you can go up into the other part of the duplex that way.
Once they get into the basement, they see a window that appears to be forced open, and the like the screen, the windowsill was missing. So they go into Mary Ann's side of the duplex, and in the second floor bedroom, they find Mary Ann's body. She had been beaten badly. Her hands were bound behind her back with a bed sheet. One end was tied around her neck, and the other end was tied around the headboard. She was face down on the mattress, didn't have any clothes on, and there was blood everywhere.
Yeah, she had been attacked with wood that seemed to have come from the window. So she had wood chips and slivers all over the place on her, and, you know, in her skin and around the bedroom. And there was also a cut on her neck that obviously came from that wood. But the coroner determined that Marianne died from asphyxia between midnight and 6 a.m.
Now they're going to do an autopsy. They're going to do all the forensics, and they're going to find sperm and other bodily fluids.
The other thing of note here is that they really did try to preserve the scene. They actually bagged her hands, and that's because they noticed there were some hairs on one of her hands, and we'll get into that later. But there's another clue found in the home. They see her checkbook on the kitchen table, and there's a receipt of payment made out to Anthony Apanovich. There are also two canceled checks that she had paid him in the past as well.
So this establishes at least some kind of lead of a relationship, you know, not being a romantic relationship, but a connection with some other person and somebody that she might have had contact with recently.
Yeah, it's important because both the back door and the front door to her side of the duplex were locked. So whoever got in either got in through that window or made their way through the other side of the duplex. But really, it appears that it was through the window that the assailant came in.
So the police are going to question the neighbors and her friends. They're going to find out that Marianne had made statements about the painter she had hired, Anthony, in the weeks and months leading up to her death. She said that she was afraid of him because he had kind of propositioned her, and she didn't appreciate that. And he had worked there painting for weeks, if not months, doing stuff for her and was getting paid.
And I'm pretty sure she was aware that he was already in a relationship.
But this is the only lead the police have to go on. So they're going to focus on Anthony, right?
Well, it's definitely the first lead because, you know, when you get to the scene, you start looking around. I would say this appears to be pretty good police work. Again, they bagged her hands. They're trying to find whatever evidence is available. They're also looking at how someone could have gotten into the house. I think this is just smart, following the leads. August 29th, 1984, the police arrest Anthony Apanovich. Now, Justin, we always say, if you're going to talk to the police, you probably shouldn't be doing it alone because you are at a disadvantage. Even if you have nothing to hide and you can be helpful, you need to have an attorney present with you. What did Tony do?
Well, Tony, he waived his Miranda rights and agreed to talk. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll do whatever. Let's straighten this out.
Not the best idea, but you know, they start with, did you know Marianne Flynn? And he says, yes, I knew her. I had worked at her house. I painted at her home. And he said, I did speak to her on the afternoon in question. Now, they saw that he had a scratch on his face. This begins kind of a multi-story explanation of how he got the scratch, because apparently, at one point, it's because he was in a knife fight.
Yeah.
Or he was cut by flying glass, or he got scratched when he was working under the hood of a person's car, or a bottle fell and broke and the glass scratched him then. I mean, there are all kinds of stories here.
And this is going to be a huge red flag for the investigators because this is the last person to see her alive. And he has an unexplained injury on his face. And I'm sorry, Aaron, but if I have a huge gash on my face, I'm going to remember how I got it. I'm not going to have 5 different explanations for this. I'm not going to misremember whether it was done under the hood of a car or in a knife fight. That's pretty, you know.
In his defense, Justin, you know, because we'll get to his alibi now. This long scratch, well, he said that he was out at different bars, okay? So he doesn't even know when and how long he was at each bar, but this got the police going to these bars to find out who was there, and they started going through these witnesses to see, did you happened to notice a, you know, Tony around, and some of them could say, oh yeah, we saw him at this time or that time. But there were definitely periods of time where no one saw him. And so his alibi isn't so good either. But if you believe that he was out drinking, well, maybe he drank a lot and he doesn't remember the scratch because, well, he had a lot to drink.
I get that. But going from working on a car to a knife fight to a bottle fell, I mean, this is a large spectrum of explanations here. And working under the hood of a car is not going to happen at a bar while you're drinking. And that's why I take issues with some of his explanations here.
Well, these are things that happened over those couple of days, right? And so at least as far as anybody knows, this is the type of guy that would be out drinking. Mm-hmm. And they say it was affecting his personal and his business life.
But so far, he's actually being forthcoming with the police. And, you know, like I said, he goes in for questioning. He's answering everything to the best of his ability. And he even volunteers blood and hair samples.
Right. They release him after a couple of days, but then he's brought back in because they want to examine his lower extremities for bite marks.
Which they probably should have done that already. They probably should have taken pictures of his entire body already, but here we are.
Right. But I think this has a lot to do with the autopsy and the findings. And then they figure, well, because of this and because of that, we basically need to start looking at this.
I would just assume if somebody has a scratch mark on their face, you would check the rest of their body.
On October 2nd, a detective called him, Tony, and informed him that he was being indicted for murder. And of course, the question is, why am I being indicted for murder? And the detective tells him, this is a high profile case and they have to get somebody. And you look worse than anybody else because all your alibi witnesses are drunks. Before we go on, Justin, there were other people who made for suspects, right? People who should have been persons of interest, but they really focused on Anthony.
Yeah. But when your alibi doesn't add up and people can't vouch for you and have marks on your face, well, you're definitely going to look a lot worse than everyone else.
But this is the part where some would say the police got tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'm not saying it's unfounded, but there were definitely other suspects. I just don't want to get into them because, well, I don't know that it's fair to those people because Anthony's the guy headed to trial and his trial started November 28th, 1984.
At trial, it's argued that Tony beat, raped, and strangled Marianne Flynn. They have the blood samples, they have fluid, they have the semen samples, all taken from her body. Witnesses testified that he had propositioned her for sex and she was afraid of him. They also present this scratch on his face and his inconsistent alibi and explanations of this scratch on his face. You know, obviously he's working at the house, so he's familiar with the layout. He could get access easier than most. And then there's blood type evidence, his blood type and the blood type of bodily fluids and semen found on her body.
Yeah, he was type A. Now, even before the defense could speak, the state filed a motion to present new evidence. They had a jailhouse informant. His name was Howard Hammond.
Oh, don't we love jailhouse informants, Saren?
Right. See, this came down because the prosecution had known that Howard Hammond had been near a Panovich in custody. And they wanted to know, did Tony say anything? And Hammond told his attorney and the prosecution that he heard Tony say, I might have done it, but they'll never prove it.
Yeah.
But he recanted his statement, and this was under oath. He said, I was over a mental strain. I lost my mother a few weeks ago. I'm back for a parole violation, probably more charges, and just got done listening to a bunch of tapes. I was drained. They came to me in the courtroom, and they hit me at the wrong time and I said something that wasn't true.
So we have this jailhouse informant, but he's going to recant. Yeah.
Now that brings up the question of, did Hammond change his testimony because the defense got to him? Well, according to Hammond, he said, they never asked me to change my testimony. So it comes down to the judge, right? The judge says, let the jury see the witness and let them judge whether he is telling the story before, telling five lawyers the same story. Did he lie all five times? Did he lie once? I think that's all things that the jury must consider and determine in the interest of justice in this case. I think the jury should be given all relevant and competent evidence. Now, Justin, I don't feel this way. I disagree strongly with the judge, because I think if you have someone giving one statement and then changing their statement, I don't understand why this person is useful in court.
Exactly. We always say that we want all the evidence to go in. And when I say evidence, I mean hard evidence. I mean forensic evidence. But when it comes to jailhouse snitches, I barely think those things should go into court at all. I almost feel like those should be inadmissible, like a polygraph test or something, because most of the time it's not relevant. Unless he told the jailhouse informant something specific about the murder, some detail that really makes him look bad, I don't want to hear from jailhouse informants myself. And the fact that this guy changed his story and recanted, I don't know why this is being allowed at all.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So let's just imagine we're the jury. This is what they heard. They heard that Anthony Apanovich did not have a good alibi, that he changed the story a number of times about how he got this scratch on his face, that he had tried to proposition the victim and that she turned him down, and had expressed to some friends that she wasn't feeling very good around him. She was nervous of him, fearful of him, and that he was familiar with her duplex.
And his blood type matches, right?
And his blood type matches, type A. That's what they hear. You might say, well, what did the defense do? Well, the defense tried to counter this stuff, but I mean, they didn't really have any tools. So I don't think, I mean, me personally, I don't think you can blame the defense because there's not really much to go on here. They can say, well, what do they really have? They don't have a smoking gun here, right? There's not this one piece of evidence that absolutely, conclusively ties their client to this crime. They can say that, But really, I mean, a lot of jurors are probably saying, well, the prosecution gave us all this stuff and the defense is just saying it wasn't him.
Yeah, which you have to counter everything. This is, you know, a trial is a debate. This is why people that are on debate teams in high school go on to be lawyers. And they're not countering any of these arguments. They're just saying there's nothing tying him to this. When in actuality, there's a lot of loose things tying him here. And if you put all that together, I don't know how else the jury is supposed to find him.
The jury did deliberate for a full day. But December 14th, 1984, Anthony Apanovich was found guilty of aggravated murder, aggravated burglary, and then two counts of rape. We're going to be coming back to these two counts of rape shortly, and we'll explain them in greater detail. But they're important because of the way that the prosecution filed these charges.
Because of the heinousness of the crime, the court is going to impose the death penalty. And when you're sentenced to the death penalty, you get an automatic appeal.
In 1986, Apanovich lost his first appeal. October 1987, the state Supreme Court rejected his appeal. This was a close vote. It was 4-3. And the dissenting justice wrote, "There is a substantial possibility the defendant may not be guilty."
That's pretty damning, but again, it's being overruled, so.
Right. But one of the justices found that the circumstantial evidence that convicted him was far from overwhelming. I don't know how to say this, Justin, other than to say they're not wrong.
I know you can say this is a circumstantial case, but a lot of circumstantial cases have hard evidence. This one, not so much, because as we find out, both he and Mary Ann had the same blood type. So at this point in time, we're not doing DNA tests. We're not doing in-depth profiling of these blood types. All we're doing is, oh, he's type A. Well, how do we know it's his blood and not her blood when it's the same type? When it comes to his alibis, well, just because his alibi doesn't pan out doesn't mean he did it. It just means that he has a bad alibi. And this just goes on down the line of all the things that they find him guilty on. So I absolutely agree that it's a shaky, loose case.
Now, Tony requested DNA testing in 1989 because, well, it was coming online, right? DNA testing started to become a thing. But the state countered with, well, we're sorry, but the slides that contained the evidence were lost or destroyed. They couldn't find them. So they didn't have any record of whether they were lost or destroyed. What would you say that is, Justin?
Well, I mean, that's just poor record keeping. And I don't know if this is a budgetary thing or just a complete lack of motive to track anything down or keep records of it.
But if they end up finding them, would you say there was a break in the chain of evidence?
Yeah. But right now, all we know is that the state is saying they don't exist anymore.
These slides are important because the coroner had taken evidence and made these slides. There are two sets of them. One set of slides is the what they call the vaginal evidence, and the other set of slides are the oral evidence. Okay. Now, these slides were discovered in 1991. They found them in a locked desk drawer of a former employee. So these slides were then sent to the Forensic Science Laboratory in California. And they made some discoveries here, Justin. They found that two of the slides were basically useless. But they said that one of the other slides, and this is one that contained oral evidence, was suitable for testing. So then it was just a wait to see if they would get authorization to test it. And in 1992, the prosecutor's office sought a DNA sample from Anthony Apanovich to test against the slides. But Tony said, no, I don't want to do this because the chain of custody had been broken. I mean, after all, they said these things are gone. We can't test it. Sorry. He had asked for them to be tested and they're saying we don't have them. Now they're saying, oh, we're about to test him. We need your DNA now. And he's like, no. So the prosecution says, fine, well, we'll get a court order.
I would assume that this is mostly coming from his attorney because let's test the evidence. Oh, there isn't any evidence to test. Now you've found it. Can we trust what you found because you didn't know it existed? I get it. And I think a lot of people might have the knee-jerk reaction of, well, if you believe in the evidence, if you believe it's going to exonerate you, then why not give them the sample? But there's a problem now. There was a break in the chain of custody.
That's how I would take it, right? It's not like it was kept in the evidence room. It was found in a locked drawer.
So now we have the state, the prosecution saying, oh, well, we're going to get your DNA anyways, and we're going to go ahead with this test. So it's no longer Anthony asking for the test. It's the state court ordering it.
Let's go on to 1999. One of the Supreme Court justices in Ohio who voted to uphold Apanovich's death sentence turned his opinion around. He now stated that he wants the state to spare Tony's life. Justice Craig Wright, he's retired at this point, but he says, I'd like you to consider commuting his death sentence. And he said that he felt like upon review that this would be the right thing to do.
Well, it's if you're going to put someone to death, you better be damn sure. And this guy is looking over the case, looking over the evidence and saying, we don't have enough here, and having second thoughts, you know, doubts about it. And I get it because a man's life is on the line. Now you could lessen his sentence to life, you know, commute it to life, but he's, you know, he's thinking he might have gotten an unfair trial. And the least we can do is look at some of this evidence and not put him to death.
In 2000, the Cuyahoga County coroner went ahead and tested the two slides that the other lab said that, you know, were useless. And they also concluded there wasn't enough DNA on the slides to do anything with. So this second set of slides, though, is useful.
And again, this is weird that nobody knows about this. It's been destroyed. And then they find it in some guy's drawer. On one side, if I'm on death row, I'm going to have hope that anything's going to help me. But on the other side, I understand the distrust in what the state and the prosecution are doing here.
October 2006 is the moment that many people were waiting for. A federal court granted the request by the prosecution to conduct DNA testing on the slides of oral and vaginal samples in that second set. And the federal court also ordered Anthony Apanovich to provide a DNA sample. Now, here's where things get crazy. The vaginal DNA was not a match for Tony at all. But the oral DNA, it could not exclude him. And in this case, that means 1 in 285 million Caucasians have DNA consistent with that left by Marianne Flynn's killer. So do we have to go over that again, Justin? I mean, it's a 1 in 285 million chance that it's not Anthony Apanovich.
I would assume that one of the slides excluding him and then the other slide being, I don't know how you come out on that, but I definitely wouldn't say I'd absolutely put my money on this, that he was guilty and this proves that he's guilty. I would put my money more on, I think this guy just got exonerated by these tests.
I don't know. I'm looking at a 1 in 285 million chance. And I think if that was my lottery chances, I would expect to still be going to work. But, you know, this is where his attorney, which at that time was Dale Bache, well, he said, you know, as far as I can tell, you had broken custody, chain of custody here. I don't know why you think you should be able to move forward with this. It feels like the court should have held an evidentiary hearing to decide whether this should have been admitted, right? Mm-hmm. before going ahead and testing everything.
Yeah. But it's almost like he asked for it to be tested, then took it back once he realized that the evidence was non-existent, or when he was told the evidence was non-existent. And then the prosecution goes forward with it, almost with the idea of, well, we have permission because he wanted it in the first place, without a court, without, you know, as you say, a hearing to see if this is proper.
Well, I think they wanted to test it to see what it would show. I think it's interesting because it seems like most of the cases we find where there's a chance to test evidence after someone's already been put away, they just go, eh, not necessary. In this case, they wanted to test it. I think that's a good thing. But the thing is that's weird because one slide says, eh, his DNA isn't here. The other one says, it could be him.
And that's where I have my doubts, regardless of the it could be him slide, because it's not definite enough for me.
Well, you have to think about the locations, Justin, right? One area of the body, well, DNA isn't going to stay there forever. Mm-hmm. And yet it'll stay there longer than the other area. It's conceivable that Marianne Flynn had been with someone days prior. It's possible. But whatever happened, you know, when they took the oral evidence, that would have been much more recent because that evidence wouldn't last in her mouth for several days. So there is a difference for me anyway.
What do these results do?
Well, the thing is, Justin, the way that he was charged with these two counts of rape, the two counts of rape weren't one count of oral rape and one count of vaginal rape. No. Each count was a carbon copy of the other. It was one count of oral and or vaginal rape, and the other charge was the same.
So he's charged twice for essentially the same crime.
No. No, they're assuming when they're, because of the evidence, that she was raped vaginally and orally. But instead of making those charges separate in a way that really was clear about which one they were talking about, they just included both on each count. You might say it's lazy, but this is what comes back to bite them. Because if they're reviewing the evidence and the vaginal slide shows that he wasn't responsible for the evidence left there, then that count, you know, he can't be held responsible for that count anymore. And yet, because both counts are the same, they can't say, well, one stays and one goes. They have to throw them both out. There's some other things here. There was a 2014 hearing, and it was argued that police and prosecutors hid three pieces of evidence. Now, the first part you already kind of talked about, because they said whoever had done this was an A-type secretor. Well, Anthony Apanovich was an A-type secretor, but the state never told anyone that Marianne was also an A-type secretor. So there's no way to tell if, you know, the evidence they collected, at least regarding the A-type, the blood A-type, well, whether it was Tony's or hers. There's also some stink made about a detective who testified in court. Tony had asked to call his mother when he was indicted. And the detective said he was stunned by this because it felt like he was admitting guilt, right? And if he's admitting guilt, well, then they've got the guy. But Tony always said, I never said it that way. I said, if I was arrested. And eventually they got his notes and they found that it was if he was arrested. There's also a matter of the hair that was found on Mary Ann's hands. And like I said, they had bagged her hands to preserve evidence, right? And there was this stink made about, well, could the hair have fallen on her hand, or was it there from the time of the crime? And the only way to really answer this question is because, well, there's a photograph that was taken of her hands because they were bound behind her back, and the hair was in her palm.
So they know it's was there.
So it really seems like, it might have been left by the perpetrator, but the hair did not match Anthony's hair.
But as we know, hair follicle evidence is, unless you DNA test it, the hair follicle comparisons aren't perfect. But again, we have one more piece of evidence that is not conclusive and in fact would side more on excluding him as the perpetrator.
Right. It's inconsistent with their person that they have said committed this crime. Now, another thing that came out was Tony had this scratch on his face, right? And if Mary Ann had scratched his face, you would think she would have some evidence of that under her fingernails somewhere. But they never did find skin under her fingernails or any kind of evidence that would tie back to Anthony Apanovich. And like I said, there were other people who should have been on the radar of the police, but weren't, apparently. Mary Ann had a violent ex-boyfriend. One of her former tenants was an attempted rapist, as far as they can tell. I mean, he could have done more than that, but that's what they know. And there was also an attempted robbery across the street on the night of the murder. And Mary Ann was known to make copies of her house key for many people, including parents she hosted in the home or unwed mothers that she hosted in the home.
As much as he fit a prime suspect or the best person of interest, there were many others here that could have made for great suspects that were not vetted at all. And here we have a man that's sitting on death row for decades based on inconclusive evidence, to say the least. I mean, we can, you know, we could go back and forth about that one slide and what was found and whether or not it excludes him or not. But everything else is pointing to somebody else. I'm surprised that the prosecution didn't say, well, you and another person did this.
Yeah, we've heard that before, haven't we? Right. Danny Brown comes to mind.
And, you know, we can't exclude that possibility that he and someone else did perpetrate this crime, but that's never brought up. That's never an option that the prosecution goes with. It's just he did it and we got a guilty verdict and it's been upheld over and over.
Well, you have to give him some credit because you've blasted other prosecutions for flipping their story around after the trial. Yeah. They're sticking with their story.
Yeah. Oh, I think they did a good job with this case overall. And know that might make some people cringe because they might be thinking this guy absolutely sounds like he was wrongfully convicted. But at the time, I think they did do their due diligence. Now, when I stop with that opinion is his second that he asked for DNA testing and they said it's been destroyed or we can't find it. Well, if they were able to get those slides for his request and not have a break in the chain of custody, I think they would have done at least their due diligence here and gotten a valid guilty verdict, even if it was not right or correct. But I know that's hard to parse out for a lot of people that somebody could be guilty, but the prosecution didn't prove it, or someone could be innocent, yet the prosecution did show that they were most likely the person, and the jury would have no other recourse but to go with a guilty plea. That's a tough pill to swallow, but it's reality in our justice system. I'm not saying it's my opinion. I'm just saying that that's how the system works.
Well, before I talk about what happened with these rape charges and how that upended this case, I do want to say that the state expert said that there was not enough evidence to make a conclusion, meaning that oral sample, it's 1 in 285 million. It sounds like a lot, but I think, you know, when it comes down to these numbers, they like to see higher numbers, and maybe it's because it was such a low sample. But either way, February 2015, the court ruled that the uncontroverted and unequivocal evidence indisputably proved that the semen found on Marianne's body was not Tony's, the vaginal evidence. And since the state went with Tony was the only perpetrator of this crime, they said, well, then he didn't kill her either. Now, remember what I had said, it's possible that, you know, this, the vaginal and the oral evidence aren't from the same person. Well, because of the way they did this trial and they didn't explain away that she may have been with a man, you know, 2-3 days before, this all looks like, well, then you got the wrong guy because this isn't matching up. So they vacated his rape convictions, because they're tied in together. They're carbon copies of each other. So you can't split them out. You can't say, well, this one's because of the vaginal slide, this one's because of the oral slide. They don't do that. They have to throw them both out. So they have to throw out the death sentence. They have to vacate that, and they release him from prison.
And they have to vacate the death sentence because the death sentence is usually a murder with another charge.
Like an aggravating factor.
Exactly. And when you throw the rape charges out, well, now you have to throw the death penalty out.
Now they're looking at a new trial.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
So Anthony Ivanovich is released from prison, and very quickly, he marries a woman named Beth. They have a child together, and he becomes this family man who's, you know, spending time with his kid and his grandkids, and he's running errands, and he's grilling, he's fixing bikes. So you go, you know, a few years down the road, 2018, he's out on bond. He's waiting for this new trial, and a SWAT team raids his house, and he's taken into custody. Why is this, Justin?
Oh, this is because they're going to be putting him back on death row due to the fact that he wasn't the one to ask for these DNA tests. If he had asked for them and then they find that they exclude him from this murder and this rape, then he's free and clear. But the accused has to be the one to request these tests.
Yeah, in technical speak, it's basically that Ohio law does not give trial court judges the authority to consider post-conviction relief motions for new DNA testing when the original DNA testing was ordered by the state, right? Since he didn't ask for it, which you and I think would argue that he did. I mean, you would think that would be on the books. He asked for it and they said, oh, we can't find it. And when they do find it, they move on their own. It's almost like they didn't give him the chance to make that move. It sounds wrong to me. Whether or not he's innocent or guilty has nothing to do with this. This just has me upset because it doesn't seem right.
So because the prosecution did the testing, it doesn't matter. They're going to put him back on death row because of this technicality. And that's messed up because, again, if they had just done the tests or had the evidence when he asked, everything would have been fine. The fact that when they did find the evidence, he said no because there's a break in chain of custody. Now, there should have been further process. There should have been something that the courts had to do to make this proper. But instead, they just did whatever they wanted to do. They tested it. Now, I personally think, Aaron, if evidence is tested, it doesn't matter who asked for it. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter who requested the testing. If the test results are enough to get you out of prison, off death row, that's all there should be. But as you stated, Ohio law, that's not how it works. So he is being treated like a fugitive, even though he was never on the run. He never knew that they were coming. They could have just come and knocked on his door and said, hey, you have to go back to prison now. He probably would have gone, but he's an accused murderer. And so they show up with a SWAT team. I think this is completely unnecessary, but that's how they do business.
There were some issues raised in court because The prosecution and defense presented arguments before the state Supreme Court on June 26, 2018. And these issues were, was a federal court's factual finding in a habeas proceeding a settled issue that could be used in the subsequent state court proceedings in the case? May a claim of a defective indictment be raised or considered in post-conviction proceedings? And does an indictment with multiple identical counts violate a defendant's protections against double jeopardy when the evidence at trial delineates a separate factual basis for each count? We went over all this. I mean, that last thing was all about the rape charges. They should have been more specific. They weren't. And I think that's where the laziness, as I would call it, of the way these charges were presented, I mean, that's what got them in trouble. If they had separate rape charges that were not identical, then I don't think he would have ever left prison. But, you know, that's the way it went. And here's the other thing. The Federal Appeals Court decided it didn't have to make a ruling on the oral slide, the DNA evidence from the oral slide, because Anthony Yovanovitch had withdrawn his innocence claims based around that slide at the time, right? Because it wasn't as much in favor for him. When it came down to the evidence, that vaginal slide is the one where he was like, oh, that's exculpatory, basically. That excludes me. But when you have a slide that's saying, it could be you, then that's inculpatory. And so he backed off of that.
But this is just a lot of legal technicalities here that, again, for us out in the world, we just think the truth should matter and we should follow your own policy and rules. And if the state doesn't follow their own rules and releases somebody and then comes back and says that's improper, it's like, well, now you're not even following your own process. You're not testing the evidence in the proper way. And regardless of this guy's innocence or guilt, it looks bad to release somebody who, if in the state's mind, he's guilty of rape and murder, well, now you've let a terrible person out onto the streets. Or was it that he actually was innocent, and now you're putting an innocent man pretty much back on death row without any sort of legal recourse? That's what this comes down to.
Well, and the prosecutor was arguing that the court didn't have the authority to do what it did because the oral rape charge, well, that basically withstood everything. And they're saying just because you don't like the way the charges were done, you know, it's still evidence that went in and doesn't exclude him. So they're saying, why do you get to make a decision on this when we already proved it? And then they go into the whole argument of, well, he did ask for the evidence to be tested. And then they said they couldn't find it, right? And then we go through all that again about, well, why did they get to go ahead with it? Don't you think they knew if they went ahead with it that he wouldn't be able to use it later?
Yeah, because again, he asked for it. Why would they want to test evidence for somebody that's already been charged and convicted and sentenced? Why do they need to test the evidence? It is extremely improper for them to do it if you're taking a defensive strategy mindset here. They had no reason to test the evidence. They could have just said, okay, we found some slides. We're not testing it, but they did test it, but then they used it against him. They can't resentence you after you've already been convicted by testing more evidence. It doesn't work that way. If they had more charges to bring about, yes, but they didn't. So it was completely improper for them to test this evidence and then essentially play with his life when they released him and then brought him back to jail.
Well, to me, I wonder if they had the evidence tested because they did worry. If you have a court justice, well, albeit retired, but saying, you know what, I wish I could take back my vote. I feel like maybe there's not enough here, especially to sentence this man to death. Maybe they're starting to doubt their own case in terms of, will it hold up? You know, will it hold up? Because over time, we've seen that some people have been released, right? And that was something that for a while that no one had to worry about. But you know, there are a lot more people getting involved now. There's a lot more pressure. And I wonder if they thought, well, if we get it tested, we can show it was him, then we're fine. We can stop him essentially from trying to appeal this anymore because we'll have the proof we need.
But it's up to the accused or the defense to ask for further testing. And he wasn't given a chance to fight this testing because he was court ordered and it was just going to happen. He didn't have any legal recourse to say, I don't want this tested and I will sue. That didn't happen because he was just told, you have to give us more samples and this is just the way the world works.
Oh, I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure they knew what they were doing.
So I think that putting someone back behind bars on a technicality such as they tested the evidence in an improper manner, meaning the defense should have done it, is not fair. And that law should change. Or the testing results should have not been admissible at all in any shape or form. Therefore, it shouldn't have made any difference. And if his defense team wanted to act upon that, then they could. But this is, it's just not fair. And it doesn't give anyone a warm and fuzzy about our system, regardless of whether I feel he did this or not. I really don't know. And the fact that the state can test more evidence and go after you further, even after you've been convicted and sentenced, it didn't seem to be part of any kind of appeal. That just seems absolutely wrong and improper.
Well, who made these rules, right? They're obviously to the favor of one side. And that's why we see this. And that's why you and I, we can agree that this feels dirty. It feels like a cheat, basically. And on top of that, you're sentencing someone to death. So Anthony Yovanovitch has remained on death row, and his challenges, his appeals, well, they just get shot down. So here he is back on death row, and there are enough people out there saying they don't think he did it. And there's definitely some questions about the evidence. There's a break in the chain of evidence. There are different problems with this case. And yet, it seems like the state feels very confident that they did everything properly and we should all move on.
And if they did everything properly, then he wouldn't have been released in the first place. They wouldn't have lost the evidence in the first place. And he wouldn't be back on death row because, again, the evidence essentially got the rape charges thrown out. Therefore, he should have been retried for murder only and see how that goes. But here we are now. He's back on death row because all that evidence, all that testing means nothing now. And he shouldn't have been ever let out. And that's something that the prosecution and the state's never going to admit fault to. I mean, they might say, sorry, we let a dangerous person out on the street and we got him back, you know, behind bars now, but where's the mistake? Where's the accountability here?
Yeah, it just feels like even though they made their own mistakes, they're not as costly to them as they are to the convicted. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.